We're about to have a conversation with Paul Chappell, who is author of the Road to Peace series, a 7-book series about waging peace, ending war, the art of living, and what it means to be human. Paul Chappell serves as the Peace Leadership Director of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation. He grew up in Alabama, the son of a half African American, half white father who fought in the Korean and Vietnam Wars, and his mother is Korean, Japanese or Korean?
She's Korean.
Korean, okay.
Yes.
And grown up in a violent household, Chappell was sought to answer these issues for war and peace and rage and trauma and vision and purpose and hope his whole life. He is a graduate of West Point, was a captain in the United States Army, in the Army for 7 years, and was a veteran of the war in Iraq. And Paul, welcome. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me, Mark.
Good to have
really
you
appreciate
back.
It.
First time you're here, you were by phone virtually. Yes. Now you're actually in studios. Good
yes,
to see you.
Thank you.
So let's talk a bit about why you're coming to Baltimore. Let's start there. Give folks a sense of why you're here. Why are you in our city?
Well, I'm giving some talks on peace, nonviolence, waging peace, ending war, and those methods for making the world better that we really need to involve ourselves in this very critical time in human history.
So let's go back to, you come from a family that's a military family.
Right.
Right? Your dad served in
The Korean War and the Vietnam War.
And the Vietnam War.
Right.
And then you went to West Point.
Right.
So, that is a different trajectory than a man who works for the peace movement. Talk about your family and why you ended up at West Point.
So one reason I went to West Point was my father was half white and half black, and he grew up in the South under segregation. So he had me when he was 54 years old. I was born in 1980. So there was a generation skip between me and him. And his generation, he's a generation before civil rights. And since I was a child, both my parents always told me the only place in America where a black man has a fair chance is in the Army. Because when my father was growing up, black men had more opportunity in the Army than they had in other parts of American
right,
society.
Right.
And I remember my father, when I was younger, he'd point at the television and he'd point at Colin Powell and he'd say, "Look at Colin Powell. He's the highest ranking person in the military and he's black." And my father would say, "Have you ever seen a black president before?" Recognizing that black men had more opportunity there. So I went to West Point. My parents were telling me their truth. That was the truth that my father had experienced and that my mother knew. And I told my mother in 2009 I was getting out of the Army. And I remember she was screaming at me on the phone. She said, "Are you crazy? Are you out of your mind?" She said, "No one's going to give you a job. No one's going to hire you." She said, "It's bad enough you look Asian, but you're also part black." She said, "Who's going to give a job to a black man who looks Asian?" And
right.
It's very interesting to me that most people I tell now that I'm half Korean, a quarter white, and a quarter black, they see it as a positive thing. That's something I could have never imagined growing up as a child. I really did not like being multi-ethnic because I felt alienated from the white community because I didn't look white. I looked pure Asian when I was a kid. Asians didn't like that my mother had married a black man, and a lot of black people, because I don't look black, didn't like that racial background. So the fact that people see mixed-race people in a more positive light today, to me, is a sign of hope. We have a lot more progress to make, but that alienation, I think, created a lot of rage as a child. And so I think one of my drivers for being interested in peace was trying to overcome that feeling of rage.
But two things you just said, just curiosity for our listeners and for me. Did you grow up identifying as black?
I grew up identifying as black and as Asian, mostly as Asian because how I looked, but my father really wanted to protect me, so my parents both tried to tell me how to get through in society. When they told me when people realize you're black, they'll treat you as if you're black. Even if you don't look black, if you are part black, they'll treat you as if you're black. So I was identified as Asian, as Korean, and as black as a child.
So you said that kind of your natural way of living wanted you to wage peace, is what you said a moment ago. So, and well, there was internal violence in your home?
Right. My father had a lot of war trauma. And just another thing to mention, my parents didn't tell me I was part black until I was in sixth grade. So it was really, really difficult for me because I thought to myself, "Oh God, it's bad enough being Asian, looking Asian. Now I'm part black too." And I think my father's war trauma, he just had so much agony and it was really frightening.
You've been through two wars.
Right, growing up around him.
I know, I've known a lot of people who've been through that and how alcoholism and violence kind of can be very pervasive in people's lives who have been really hit by war in a very deep way. Right. So I understand that completely. But you said you grew up trying to want to wage peace, but you still went to West Point because that was part of family tradition, because you thought that was the way you had to get through life because of being black and Asian. I mean, was it because you wanted to go and defend your country, or all those things?
I think it was a combination of factors. I think that I felt that I had limited opportunity, but also I grew up very conservative. I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh every day. I mean, every day in high school. I think I was probably to the right of Rush Limbaugh, and I really believed in those values and ideals, and I really wanted to serve my country. And also, West Point is free if you get accepted. So neither of my parents graduated from college, so my parents were lower middle class, so that was a really, really good educational opportunity for me, and I think those combination of factors led me there.
So you went to West Point, and then you became a second lieutenant. You wound up being a captain in the United States Army.
Right.
And you went to Iraq.
Right.
And what was your experience in Iraq?
Well, my transformation of thinking had begun earlier, but I think that continued the trajectory that I was on.
Because the captain is a very tough position in the Army.
Right.
I mean, because you're in the midst of it. You're with your men, and the men are fighting, and so are you.
Well, I was in a role. I was in the Air and Missile Defense Branch, and I was with a unit called CRAM, where we would install these systems that would intercept mortar rounds. So I went to various bases and that would help install this system. I wanted a more self-defense role. My attitude had shifted enough by that point. I had been reading a lot of Gandhi, and I saw how Gandhi was a medic in the British military.
Right.
And I thought, well, I should do something more self-defense related, because my views had changed. Plus, I also knew myself really well at that point. I knew that I had a lot of kind of berserker rage, and I should be in a position.
Berserker rage, is that what you said?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. That just from my upbringing, I had a high capacity to become enraged. And so I should probably be more in a self-defense kind of role, where I might not be in that kind of situation.
So then what led you to leave the U.S. Army?
I can think various things. I was having some mental problems, and I think also my views had shifted in various ways, and it was a pretty difficult time. But I got out in 2009, and I began working for the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation that same year. So I was very fortunate that I was able to start doing some work for peace right after.
So these were 7 years that you served after you got out of West Point, or the 7 years total?
7 years in the Army, so from 2002 to 2009.
Right. Yes. So you knew what you wanted. You knew where you were going when you left the Army, obviously.
I didn't know how I would be able to sustain myself. I got that job with the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation kind of late, so I wasn't sure what was going to happen, but things worked out, thankfully.
So let's talk a bit about where you see all this Army. Here we are, looking at the world at the moment. We're in the midst of going back into another bombing campaign in Iraq and most likely Syria, given the Islamic State, and it's a very tough thing. We had an interesting debate on this program last week with between two people, both of whom opposed the war in Iraq. One was Iraqi and one was an American, and they really disagreed on what should happen. The American saying we should not bomb and be involved in any way like that, and the Iraqi leftists who opposed Saddam and opposed the war saying, no, our people are being slaughtered. You have to come in and help us fight. You're the one who started this. So it's interesting to hear their respect, how they viewed this.
Right.
So how about yourself? I mean, how are you viewing where we are now, given your view on peace and your view on and having been an Iraq veteran yourself?
Well, I think we are in a position where we are seeing the limitations of military force. I think a good example is the situation in Russia, where we cannot use military force against Russia directly because they have nuclear weapons.
Right.
There is no military option.
Right.
And we can...
One would hope anyway.
Right.
Right.
But there is no practical military solution to that situation. And we can posture, we can threaten them, but they know that we're just posturing because they know we're not going to attack them with the nuclear weapons that they possess. So I think in the same situation, though, in Iraq, we're seeing the limitations of the military force. It's a kind of situation where the military method really cannot get to the root of the problem. And this is just a non-political discussion, in the sense that if you look at that, the application of military force, how can the military force really get to the root of this problem? And violence cannot kill an idea. And you look at the man who executed the hostages, he had a British accent. So there's people in Britain, there's maybe people in the U.S. who identify with that group. And how can the military option really confront that effectively?
So I've heard, so let's talk about what you think our options are as human beings at this point.
Well, I think that situations like this are going to have to force us to actually get to the root of these kinds of problems. And we really have to get to the root problem of violent fundamentalism, because before it was Al-Qaeda, now it's ISIS. If you defeat ISIS or ISIL, it'll be another fundamentalist group in the future. You see the rise of radical ideologies even in the Western states. And I think that we really have to go to the root of our problems rather than just addressing these symptoms. And if we do deal with ISIS, that won't guarantee that another fundamentalist group will arise two or three or four, 10 years from now. So we really have to get to the root of our problems at this point in human history.
On our way to talking about what you think the root of the problems are, I watched a piece with you in it where you were speaking to a group. I'm not sure where you were. But you were talking about that you asked this question to the audience. You said, how many believe that we're innately violent? How many people do you believe we're innately peaceful? How many people think humankind is innately both?
Yeah.
And talk a bit about your – I really want to talk about that, because I think that's an age-old discussion. It's a discussion that, you know, people have been having – wrestling with for a long time. But your perspective on that.
Yeah. So one thing I talk about a lot is that humans aren't naturally violent. And now people can certainly become violent. So what I'm saying is that violence has causes, that we should see violence the way that we see illness. So if somebody gets malaria or HIV or Ebola, no one ever says, oh, that's human nature. People realize something has gone wrong and there's a preventable cause. But we don't see violence that way. So when we look at gang violence, people say, well, that's just how people are. They don't think about poverty. They don't think about hopelessness, lack of opportunity, trauma, those things that increase people's propensity for violence. And the evidence I look at to show that we're not naturally violent is military history, which offers overwhelming evidence that we're not naturally violent. Just to offer one piece of evidence is the fact that war traumatizes the human brain. I mean, war is extremely traumatizing to the human brain. And if we were naturally violent, why wouldn't people go to war and become more mentally healthy? Why would war traumatize the brain? If we were naturally violent, why would raising a child in a loving, peaceful environment be good for the human brain? Why would raising a child in a violent, abusive environment be bad for the human brain? Also, the fact that people are afraid of violence. If somebody shoots up an area, or if there's any kind of violent attack, people's instinct is to run. They have a stronger instinct to run away than to fight. That's why armies have to recruit people, train people, motivate people to fight in combat, because it is human nature to not want to get stabbed or shot or killed. So you have to have some sort of outside motivator, fighting for your family, fighting for freedom, fighting for a better way of life, fighting for your country, to propel people into combat.
And I think when you ask the question, I've really wrestled with this a lot myself, and both in discussion and internally. Because when you posit the question as, are we innately violent, maybe the question is conflict, for various reasons, innate in humankind? And I can't think of a human society where conflict did not exist, that sometimes led to armed conflict or violent conflict, often even in societies, let's say, the Iroquois or some other indigenous people, where internally the society was very peaceful. Externally, when it came to fighting other nations that they thought were that they had to fight for numerous reasons, they were really vicious, like most of humankind. Not just so. What I'm saying, even in the most peaceful societies, that's an aspect. That's so. If you just don't think about just violence, but that aspect of conflict, isn't that innately part of who we are, and or the battle to make it not. Well, let me just stop there.
Yeah, I think conflict is just a natural part of nature and reality. Just nature itself involves struggle, but conflict isn't always a bad thing. Conflict is often a good thing. Conflict makes you grow. Struggle makes you grow. You go to the gym, you exercise your muscles grow stronger. Without conflict and struggle, your mind cannot develop. And if you and I have a conflict, that can lead to greater clarity where you and I disagree on something. And this is just completely natural.
Right, right.
You see it your way, I see it my way. We talk about it. Now I have better understanding of how you see the world. We have greater clarity. Many people have conflict and they grow closer together. So what is not bad is conflict. What is dangerous is destructive conflict resolution. So if you have you and I have a conflict, this is an opportunity for both of us to grow. Conflict only becomes bad when I realize and I say, well, I'm going to resolve my conflict by punching you in the face.
Right.
But I think in our culture, people are very terrified of conflict. But I try to see conflict as an opportunity, something that can make us stronger. And if you think about your own life, most of your wisdom and maturity probably came from struggle. And
Absolutely.
Situations of conflict
Absolutely.
And struggle. And you wouldn't be who you are today without that.
And there's no question.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the question of what kind of society and culture we can create, I mean, if somebody asked me the question, do you think we could ever live in a world without war? My response would be no. But if you ask me, and I really want you to respond to this because of the things I've seen you say and write, I'm very curious about what you're going to say. But if someone said, can we build a society where war is lessened, it becomes not part of a major part of your existence, I might say yes. So I'm saying, I mean, because it's kind of this dialectical struggle about who we are as human beings, how do we get to a place that's more peaceful than not?
Right. Well, that's a really good point. So I think my viewpoint is really influenced by my own experience with trauma. And I realized that people can become so enraged that you have to use physical force. What trauma can do to the brain in terms of berserker rage, I think you'll always have to have some sort of law enforcement. Let's say that 1 out of 1,000 humans has the propensity to be a repeat violent offender,
right.
Maybe from trauma, from whatever causes that might be influencing them. 1 out of 1,000. So if you have a community of 500 people, that's not too bad. If you have a community of 1,000 people, you can handle that one person. But if you have a community of 300 million people, that is 300,000 violent people. And you have to have some sort of law enforcement. You're going to have serial killers. You're going to have child molesters. You're going to have people who want to extort money from people just because you have such a large population. But war, I think, is a very different situation. War is politically organized violence. The amount of resources that go into war are enormous. You have to have political propaganda. You have to have the national engine behind it. And you have to have high-tech weaponry. So we might have a future where you do have serial killers or you do have child molesters and murderers. We can reduce those numbers, though. It's better to have fewer violent amounts of violent crime than more. But I think that the apparatus for war requires national consent.
So how do you think we begin to get to a place where war is an anomaly? War is less. War is not among us. How do you think we get to that place?
Well, I think we are moving in that direction now. I think that attitudes toward war have changed dramatically in the past 50 and even 100 years, where there's a reason why there's no draft today in the U.S., because if there was a draft, we would have never gone to Iraq, and people would be rioting.
It's true.
And
that's true.
One reason why we are using drones is because there is much different national and global opinion about civilian casualties. And drones, the people in power claim drones don't kill civilians. They do kill civilians. But you can't carpet bomb a city. You can't destroy an entire city the way you could Dresden or Tokyo or the way you could napalm villages in Vietnam. Public outrage would deter that. So we have these drones. They do kill fewer civilians. The propaganda says they don't kill civilians. And most people today, if there was a draft in the U.S., they would very highly resist. So I think that attitudes have changed. But the war system has been able to adapt very effectively. And I think drone warfare is one adaptation where the war system has tried to separate the population from the reality of war.
So I wonder in some ways if is it some of the danger of war being perpetual in our world is the fact that we don't have a draft.
Right.
I mean, I agree with you. So, right. I mean, because I was one of those who was during the Vietnam War But looking back on it now, I mean, I realize that that's one of the reasons we were able to do what we're doing now, because we have a world of professional soldiers. That's all they are. There's no kind of mass army. So that means we should go back to the draft. How do you what should we do? How do we wage peace? How do we do, as you write about, and how do we create the art of waging peace? How does that fit into all that?
Well, I think we have to create a paradigm shift in how we perceive conflict, conflict resolution, peace. And I think this is an enormous transformation. This is the kind of transformation in worldview that people have not seen in literally hundreds of years. And the only thing I can compare it to recently is I often don't, when I talk to people, how much things have changed. And when I talk about how much things have changed, people think about civil rights and gay rights and even women's rights. Women 200 years ago couldn't vote, couldn't own property. But something that is just an example people don't even think of is really radical change, where if you go back a few hundred years, most people thought that the Irish were subhuman. And
right.
you
right.
could, under English law, you could murder or rape an Irish person. And because that person was Irish, you wouldn't be prosecuted. There was no such thing as white people back then. People thought that there were different races in Germany, different races in France. And people, if you go back 2,000 years, people used to practice things like human sacrifice, animal sacrifice. Things that today anybody running for political office just could not advocate. So I think that we have to have a dramatic shift in how we see conflict, peace, violence. And this understanding that violence has causes, I think, is a simple idea, but it's very challenging to get that idea through, that when there is a violent situation, there have been causes that we can prevent.
So let's talk about how you think that we begin that. I mean, you have this book, The Cosmic Ocean.
Right.
And you talk about how you didn't use the word beauty, but treasures or whatever, that you can pull out of trauma.
Right.
That has to do with the healing and building a new world. How does that connect to all this?
Well, I find that most of the insights I've gained in life, my greatest teacher, as I say, has been trauma. I think that rage and trauma have taught me a lot about humanity. And I see, for me, rage is probably my greatest teacher in terms of what insights I've been able to glean from the human condition. And what I mean by that is I understand what can make people enraged to the point of almost being insane. I'm talking about wrath, where you just want to destroy everything. And so I really relate to that emotion. And I realize how painful it is. And I realize what can make people become like that. Things like alienation, trauma, isolation, hopelessness, humiliation, being disrespected, not having opportunity. It can just drive you in your rage almost to a point of madness. And so when I talk about we're not naturally violent, I do not underestimate the siren song of rage and how compelling that voice can be and the damage it can do. But I understand why I became like that and why I was able to get out of that pit. And it leaves scar tissue in your brain. You never fully overcome it, but you learn how to manage your life with those tendencies. And you can still have a meaningful, productive, fulfilling life with that scar tissue still in your brain.
I think that's true. I mean, so you're saying you can extrapolate that lesson out to society in a larger way.
There's just so much evidence. We have to look at all the evidence. If you look at the violent criminal population, the vast majority of people in the violent criminal population have some sort of childhood abuse.
Absolutely.
If you look at serial killers, the most arguably the most common characteristic of serial killers is social isolation, alienation. If you look at mass murderers, serial killers, and this feeling of isolation, not having a community, being an outcast, being alone, it can really drive up your sense of rage. And so these are very serious things, but if these things have causes, if being a serial killer or a mass murderer is because something has gone wrong in this person's upbringing. If you look at the world, there's millions of people who have malaria. There's millions of people who are malnutrition, millions of people who have HIV. But that doesn't mean it's human nature. It means that something has gone wrong. There is some hope that we can make people healthier. I'm actually surprised there aren't more violent people. I'm surprised that there are so many people in poverty who are alienated, who have trauma, that aren't killing people.
Right.
And that, to me, is the big miraculous, mysterious thing is I'm actually amazed that there aren't more people shooting up places in the U.S. considering how much trauma I think is really out there. I think that we can rethink our society. We can think about how can we create conditions where people are able to have a healthy, functioning, productive, meaningful, purpose-driven way of life.
So what does your work take you next in terms of how to build this, and what do you leave us with?
All progress in human history comes from changing how people think. ideas is really what changes how people think. And 200 years ago, women couldn't vote, women couldn't own property, women couldn't go to college, black people were slaves, and that has changed because people see the world differently. And so I think that, again, we have to transform how people think about these issues. And this is a very difficult conversation because people want the quick fix. Right. People want the easy answer.
Right.
But this problem is such a serious, major, transcendent kind of issue that we really have to have a much more comprehensive approach to dealing with it.
Yeah, this has been fascinating. I'm glad you came to Baltimore. I'm glad we finally had you in the studio and finally met you. And I would encourage everyone to we will tack on to this on our website to go to Paul K. Chappelle, CHAPPELL.com. Thank you so much for dropping by the studio. It's great to meet you at last and have you here.
Thank you so much, Mark. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.